something we may have heard recently.
I was going to say, I apologize if I I say something.
Well, I was just suggesting that to the extent your message is any different, or maybe a different drug in your bag, you might emphasize that.
Maybe a few points I can emphasize that are a little different, but if I cut across what was said before, I apologize. We're appealing from the district court's grant of summary judgment to the defendant. Our central position is that there's a regulation on point here. It's the DOL's promotion regulation. It squarely provides on point that the employee promotes products that are sold by others. That is, he promotes products and his actions stimulate the sales by others, then he's not exempt. And that language we submit is reasonable on its face, and it's unambiguous as applied here. That's exactly what these pharmaceutical detailers did. The defendant has not challenged that regulation as unreasonable, and it has not said that it does not it has said it does not apply here because it doesn't define the meaning of sales.
When you use pharmaceutical detailers, your opponent made a distinction in the fact that that's an old term that really doesn't apply to what you're doing now.
Your Honor, I agree that there's different job titles you can give an employee. Our position is that job titles don't hold sway, that there's a regulation on point that provides that an employee's job title doesn't matter in determining an exemption or his duties. If you put weight on a job title, that could allow an employer to skew what the real duties are, and that's basically our position, that these people don't do sales. They might be called salesmen, but they're really, as was previously called, they're really pharmaceutical detailers. They do the same thing that those people did. They don't sell drugs within the context of the regulations or within the context of the statute. And getting back to the promotion regulation, like I said, the department's interpretation of that is entitled to controlling deference under Chevron. And if not under Chevron, it's entitled to deference under Auer if that regulation is ambiguous. And if not under Auer, it's entitled to respect under Skidmore. The defendant essentially seeks to have this court apply de novo review here. It doesn't apply Chevron or Auer Skidmore. That is wrong. It doesn't address the department's position in its amicus brief until 15 pages into its outside sales argument and spends 5 pages on it. With respect to the position that the Department of Labor has acquiesced in the practice here and somehow approved it, the law is clear on that an agency's inaction on a subject does not constitute approval of a policy. And the Supreme Court's decision in Heckler v. Cheney is pretty irrelevant on that. It provides that an agency's prosecutorial discretion to enforce the laws as it sees fit is judicially unreviewable. And the allocation of resources is up to the agency. It's not up to the courts to determine what the agency is doing with its resources. So to say that the DOL has sat back and it's sitting back on its haunches to somehow approve the action here is just wrong. There has to be an authoritative and definitive statement by DOL that these employees are exempt as outside salesperson. There has never been that. As far as there's no notice and comment here, through this amicus brief, Supreme Court has recently been clear on that agency amicus briefs are entitled to controlling deference where reasonable, or rather not plainly erroneous or inconsistent with regulations. And in fact, defendant argued below that the DOL's amicus brief in another case was entitled to controlling deference. As far as the argument that the DOL's position parrots the statute, that is wrong too. The regulation on point, the promotion regulation, doesn't parrot any statute. It's clear on its face that it applies to employees who promote products that are not sold by others. In the Supreme Court's decision in Gonzales, the agency's regulation there, DOJ's regulation or interpretation, squarely just parroted the statute at issue. That's not this case. And the Seventh Circuit's decision in Harrell is very analogous to the situation. And as far as the definition of sale in Section 203K, we submit that just to isolate and look at the 203K, the definition of sale by itself, as defendant is proposing here, is inappropriate. The court has to look at the regulations and the statute as a whole. The statute at issue is Section 213A1, which is the outside sales exemption. It's not 203K. The DOL adopted 203K as part of the exemption, so therefore the DOL's regulations are what's controlling here, not the definition of sale in 203K. But even if we look at Section 203K, the ordinary meanings of the term therein, shipment for sale, consignment, so forth, other disposition, if you look up the ordinary meanings of those, and we cited many cases in our briefs on it, they all talk about a transfer of property or title for consideration. And therefore, the DOL's position in its amicus brief and its regulations is consistent with that provision. And also under the doctrine of a justum generis, and this Seventh Circuit's decision in Ham, talking about you have to consider the statute and regs as a whole.
What do you do with the preamble, the language of the preamble, 2004 preamble?
To the extent it talks about in some sense make sales, the defendant claims is flexible. Well, first of all, you only
it
get...
It also talks about making obtaining a commitment to buy.
Yeah. Well, there's no commitments to buy that were obtained here. First of all, that's just rewriting the preamble language and the regulatory language it provides. You have to obtain a commitment to buy. That wasn't obtained here. What they're saying, they're twisting the language to get it rewritten to say commitment to prescribe, which is not what the intent of DOL is in that language. But again, the language in the regulation is clear on its face and unambiguous. You don't get past the regulation and look at the preamble language when that's the case under Chevron. You only look at the preamble language if the regulation is unclear on its face. But even if you do look at the preamble, the DOL's interpretation is not plainly erroneous or inconsistent with the regulations. Basically, if this decision is upheld, Your Honors, it'll eviscerate the agency's promotion work regulation, and employees who perform purely promotional duties will be deemed exempt in the future. The Second Circuit's decision addressed this succinctly and reasonably, and it came to a conclusion that we think is proper and should be followed here. And also, I want to speak briefly about the purpose of the...
Something I have with that argument is that what these folks apparently do seems to be awfully different from the examples given for promotion work in the regulation.
But these folks
don't stack shelves.
Well, but the regulation is clear. If you promote products that stimulate sales by others, or is incidental to sales by others, then you're not exempt. What the exact duty? Those are examples in the regulations. They're not all inclusive. The regulations are clear, and these sales in the company are made by a separate division to wholesale distributors, and the reps in this case have nothing to do with those sales. And the company's accounting policies only recognize revenue coming into the company when there is a sale to the wholesale distributor. They don't recognize revenue under their accounting policies when there's a sale made at a pharmacy of a Lilly drug. And that's why, as Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook talked about, the issue of whether they got credit for sales here is incorrect. They only got credit if there was a prescription that was filled in the territory in which they worked. They didn't get credit if they obtained or sought a commitment to buy from the commitment to prescribe from the doctor. There's no record of that in any evidence, and they don't keep track of any commitments to obtain here. So we believe that the department's application of the exemption here should be upheld under Chevron, Auer, or Skidmore. On the administrative exemption, our position is basically that these employees did not exercise the requisite discretion. They were strictly subject to scripts and verbatims. They were closely monitored by the defendant, and this is a highly regulated industry. The employees had no authority to deviate from those scripts, notwithstanding what the defendant is saying. And this court in Roe Midget.
I can't believe that. I can't believe that anybody who appeared with a script from which you could not deviate could possibly be persuasive. Suppose you showed up with a script for your oral argument. You're trying to sell us your legal position. You show up with a script. We ask you a question, and all you can say is, I can't deviate from my script. Please let me continue reading. You'd be the most unpersuasive person in Chicago, right? And you're saying that that's what your clients do, that their employer deliberately makes them utterly unpersuasive. That's awfully hard to buy.
Well, that's the truth, Your Honor. And they trained heavily on these scripts. They practice them, and they memorize them. And we submit, the record reflects that. The Joint Appendix cites at page 98, page 101.
Why are they so well paid if, in your view, they are utterly useless because they can't answer anybody's question and won't, even if they can?
Your Honor, I can't answer why they're well paid. The defendant has its reasons. I'm not sure about that, but
it's off script.
if they go off script, they can get in trouble on that. But at pages 98,
is your oral argument scripted? If so, you're hiding it from us very well because you're answering our questions rather than returning to your script.
Yes, Your Honor, but again, the issue here, again, back is whether the DOL's interpretation is entitled to deference. It's not a de novo review. And it's whether what the agency is drawing from the facts here. And the facts, again, have to be reasonably construed in favor of a plaintiff. I see my time is up, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal. Unless the Court has any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Ms. Stark.
Good morning, Your Honors. I represent the Department of Labor as amicus in this appeal. There's been a lot of discussion about the Department of Labor regulations already this morning, so I won't belabor those points. I did want to point out, though, that the Department of Labor's regulations, in particular, are regulations in 541.503, do draw a bright line between promotion work and sales work. This bright line was drawn as far back as 1940 when the Stein Report and the Weiss Report were developed, 1949, sorry. And one of the things that happened between 1940 and 1949 is that we proposed a regulation which is now found in 541.504, drivers who sell. And that's where a lot of these indicia that were discussed in these very early reports ended up. When you have drivers whose part of their job is driving the truck, delivering the product, and the other part of their job is selling, you know, we look to see a number of different factors to determine whether their entire day should be exempt. But really the key regulation here is under sales, the outside sales exemption, is 541.503. Congress delegated to the Department of Labor 72 years ago the authority to define and delimit these exemptions, and we have done so. We have done so in many, many different industries with many kinds of workers. We've changed our regulations from time to time, but we have been consistent since at least 1949 in drawing this bright line distinction between promotion and sales. And if you look at our regulation in section 541.503 B and C, we do use these words. We're trying to distinguish between promotional activities that are designed towards consummation of the employee's own sales, in which case his entire day might be spent in exempt sales activity because he is partly promoting and partly selling, and someone who is simply a promoter paving the way for someone else who will come later and actually sell a product after the persuasive activity has ceased. And the way that we view these employees, based on the facts as found in district court in both the Schaefer-LaRose and the Girard cases, which we, again, think are very similar to the facts in the Novartis case, which came from the Second Circuit, we believe that these individuals are engaging in classic promotion activity, persuasive activity, and we define that as outside the realm of sales. I would like to point out that although the statute does contain a listing of things, including consignment, all of these things obviously are sales within the meaning of the law, our regulation goes further. And again, this is found in 541.501. We have issued regulations pursuant to congressional direction after notice and comment. For example, stating that people who sell advertising time are exempt. So there's no transfer of property, there's no tangible item that's passing back and forth, but there's clearly a sale for which compensation is being paid. Selling of ad space in newspapers, selling of services. There are a lot of different examples where taking orders or generating orders or having some role in the sale that's eventually made, you know, is done by the outside salesperson or might be done by someone else. And so what we try to do in our regulations, rather than just limiting the regulation to the language of 3K, which is clearly, you know, the beginning of the list, we've included taking orders and selling advertising space and other things within our definition of who is an outside salesperson. So it's not just a 3K, what is a sale? It's who is a salesperson under 13A1, which is what Congress intended for the Department of Labor to define.
Well, I understand then that those, say, in-house people that produce advertisements for pharmaceuticals are not sales?
They're not, certainly not outside sales, Your Honor. They could be inside sales, and inside salespersons are not exempt. This is the outside sales regulation. Now, again, in this case, there's no dispute that they work outside. We all agree on that. You know, but truck drivers work outside, too. So working outside really is not dispositive. You have to also be making a sale. So I would just refer the court to the Novartis decision, which quotes this language. It's the same language in the 1940 report. It's the same language in the 1949 report, and we have included that language in the 2004 preamble and also in the regulations in section 541.503 and 504. None of that language about promotion and sales and truck drivers and indicia, none of that is found in the statute. That has all been developed by the Department of Labor, over the last 72 years that we've interpreted the statute pursuant to our congressional mandate. So I would completely agree with my colleagues who said that the regulations are not ambiguous. They are clear. They answer the question. We think that these individuals, with regard to sales, are not making sales. They're legally prohibited from making sales. What they're doing is promoting, and therefore they're not exempt under the outside sales exemption. If I could turn my attention to the administrative exemption, again, it's a fairly simple analysis. We look at the regulation, which was promulgated by notice and comment pursuant to congressional direction. The regulation was updated in 2004 to require discretion and independent judgment with regard to matters of significance. I would agree with Your Honor that they don't actually read scripts. That's probably not an accurate representation of what they do. But they do have to follow a script. They're permitted to ad-lib to some extent, but essentially their job is...
Does the department agree with decisions such as those that hold that a financial account rep is an administrator?
I would say there's certainly... If you give me a specific case, I could answer a little better, but we have a list, a long list, actually.
John Olden Life Insurance. Does the department agree with that? Obviously, the department lost that case.
Yes, Your Honor, we did lose that case. We cited that case in our preamble. That is the law. We don't disagree with it. I mean, I think that what has happened now is that you've seen dozens and dozens of cases of people who do high-level administrative work, and so you have a lot of examples of people who do different kinds of work. In that case, I would just point out there were also a number of salesmen. What the account managers or whatever they were called, what those people did was they interfaced with the salesmen. They were not actually the outside salespersons themselves. They were at a higher level, and they were supervising or interfacing with something like 500 salesmen who were out there selling the product. So their job, I do think, was at a higher level and required a substantial degree more discretion and independent judgment than the examples that I have seen. Again, we're going with what the district court described as the duties. But in both of these cases, these representatives of pharmaceutical people, they had to stick fairly close to the pre-approved messages because the FDA requires that those messages be essentially pre-approved by the FDA. So they can't say, oh, well, even though my FDA material says this drug is supposed to be good for rheumatism, I'm going to tell you that you could also use this drug for...
Completely different. The FDA approves what it is you can promote a drug for. It doesn't approve the sales scripts.
Well, Your Honor, the sales scripts are developed in accordance with the guidelines and the regulations. That's the problem.
I understand. I certainly understand that Eli Lilly does not want its reps to promote a drug for off-label use.
Yes, sir.
Because that's going to get the company in really hot water.
Yes, sir.
That, of course, is a different proposition from saying that Eli Lilly is going to say, you can use these words only and nothing else.
We agree that they're permitted to ad lib and they're encouraged to make it sound like it's a genuine, original conversation. That's their training. One other thing I would just point out, Your Honor,
Mr. O'Brien actually had scripted answers to all of the questions I asked him. He was just making it sound like he didn't.
I think Mr. O'Brien used the highest level of discretion and independent judgment, Your Honor. If I could just make one other point about the highly paid question that had been discussed earlier this morning. We do have a separate exemption in the regulations for highly compensated employees. You don't need to fit within the administrative exemption if what you're arguing is that your employees are so highly compensated that they don't deserve overtime. But that has not been briefed or argued in any of these cases, to my knowledge. So that's just another factor, but it's not relevant to this test.
Thank you very much, Ms. Starrett.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Poshkoff.
Thank you. May it please the Court.
I let Ms. Starrett go well past her red light because I assume my colleagues wanted to find out as much as we could about the position of the Department of Labor, but I will add 5 minutes to your time as a result.
Well, thank you. I may not need it because as a result of all the questions and answers, I am discarding some of my prepared materials in the interest of efficiency.
So you do not have a prepared script, which you were required to use.
I do not have a script. But I do want to pose this question as to kind of to frame up, you know, this is the Lilly case, and so it is unique and it is the same in some respects. But from our standpoint, the question presented by our case is whether a Lilly employee who made $100,000 a year, who worked without daily supervision, who set her own schedule, who described her job as being a scientist, whose job was to meet with physicians, other scientists, to try to persuade them to prescribe Lilly products, is that person the type of person that's entitled to and required to be paid overtime under the Fair Labor Standards Act? That's the question that we see presented by our case and, to a certain extent, the Abbott case. And the district court said no. And the reason the court said no was because of the outside sales exemption and the administrative exemption. I'm not going to talk too much about outside sales, certainly willing to answer any questions, but in response to some of the questions by the panel, yes, this is an extraordinary transaction. This transaction is unique. The person who can authorize the purchase, the doctor, is not the consumer. So this does set this transaction aside from many, if not all, other transactions. And frankly, as you know, these cases are pending across the country, and I can't find a lawyer that's found another example of something just like this. This is unique because in the context of pharmaceutical sales, the law says a patient can't just go get a prescription. The doctor has to prescribe it. And so there's a process that occurs here that starts with the doctor writing this prescription, the patient taking to the pharmacy, getting it filled, etc. So this is a unique transaction. But the statute does talk about making sales, and it is a labor statute. For all purposes relevant to the work conditions, this is sales. The sales rep works away from the place of business. She sets her own hours. She decides how much or how little time to put into the job. She works to obtain commitments in appropriate circumstances. And, yes, she gets incentive compensation, as Judge Easterbrook noted. Why is that important? Because the concept of sales is the harder you work, the more you may earn. It's decoupling hours worked.
So what that has to do with sales. Many inventors are paid a percentage of the sales of the things they invent, but that doesn't make them salesmen. Corporate CEOs are paid a percentage of the corporation's gross profits. That doesn't make them salesmen. So I'm just puzzled by what relation the compensation system could be. I understand salesmen's compensation based on a percentage of what they sell, but this compensation is based on all sales in the territory, whether they sold it or not, whether they visited the physician or not, whether they had anything to do with it or not.
And that's the only way it can be done in this industry. Of course, you can't track the prescription.
But of course, one is inclined to say the reason that that's the only way it can be done is because these people are promoters and not salesmen.
Well, I think the reason the incentive compensation is important is because if you look at the nature of this job, the idea of incentive compensation is the harder that you work, the more you can get paid. And yes, you're right, Judge, it is inexact. You could have a broken hip and be at home and somebody would still be writing a prescription. But clearly, these pharmaceutical companies, and the record reflects, track the performance of people by judging whether or not they're moving market share.
Mm-hmm.
So it is inexact. You're totally correct. But if you look at...
I'm perfectly willing to assume that the pharmaceutical companies are not wasting their money when they pay these...
Retail
representatives.
But if you move on from that and we talk about the work conditions, because this is a labor statute, and we've heard, you know, for tax purposes it might be this, and for securities purposes it might be this. This is a labor statute. Everything about this job reflects sales. They're recruited as sales reps. They're trained as sales reps. They're evaluated. They're paid as sales reps. And, of course, they call themselves sales reps, not surprisingly. Going back to the idea of compensation, when they drafted the Fair Labor Standards Act, there was the idea that certain jobs that have higher benefits, higher compensation, and more freedom are not the type of jobs that should be subject to overtime. And that's what the court noted, among other things, in the, I don't think I'll say the name right, but the Verculian case, basically said that certain jobs where you have a lot of discretion don't fit neatly into the statute for overtime. So for all those reasons, that's why it makes sense to conclude that this is making sales. Now, I just want to briefly mention promotion work because that did come up in the Department of Labor's argument and in my adversary's argument. The promotion work regulation doesn't define sales. It doesn't tell you what a sale is. All it says is if activities are directed towards your own sales, then they're sales. It doesn't say what a sale is. So we don't think that the promotion work regulation defines this. We think you've got to look back at the plain meaning of the statute, which is broadly defined, and the purposes of the statute. So basically that's, I think, the points that haven't been covered and maybe some of them that have already been covered on the point of sales. I'd like to move on to administrative that we haven't discussed very much. The district judge ruled, for all the same reasons that we've been talking about, the freedom, the discretion, setting your own hours, the scientific nature of this job, the judge said, yes, this is also administrative work. Now, the administrative exemption has three requirements. One, salary. The minimum is $455 a week, so a little more than $20,000 a year. This employee made $100,000 a year, so obviously that's met. And by the way, the Department of Labor has said that the amount of money you make can be an indicia of how important your job is and whether it should be subject to overtime. So we can put that to the side. The second, and there was a question about this, I believe, from one of the judges, is it has to be work related to general business operations. And that means kind of the white-collar work, work running the business or servicing the business. And you, Judge, asked the question, well, is this met by particular sales? The answer to that question is, in this situation, yes. The particular sales cases, by the way, the Martin case is a very old case, which has been overruled, and the only other case on that is the Reisig case from the Second Circuit. So there isn't a lot of case law saying that particular sales can't be administrative. But the Department of Labor itself says outside salespeople can also be doing administrative work. The reason? General business operations, which we're talking about, relates to the type of work. It's a general type of work, such as promotion, tax, finance, procurement, systems analysts, database analysts, a wide variety of types of work. There's nothing in that regulation that says anything about how it can't be particular.
In answer to one of my questions, one of the counsel in the earlier case said that these folks come in to see the physician to sell one, two, or three particular products, and that's all. The physician doesn't want to talk about them, wants to talk about something else. They can't do it. Is that correct?
I think that I would not say that's totally correct. I think it's correct in part. I don't think a sales representative would sell a product for which they didn't have the disease state knowledge, the scientific information, the label information. So if a doctor said, I want to talk to you about a product that they knew nothing about, I think that they would defer the question. However, sales reps don't just walk into the office and say, I want to talk to you about Zyprexa. They engage in a dialogue with the physician to understand their patient population, to understand what their needs are, to understand what products might fit those needs. So I would hope that the good sales rep, when having a conversation about a doctor and the doctor raises something that's not on their list of products, would be able to turn that into a meaningful interaction about the types of patients the doctor sees.
Would that sales rep follow up with that doctor's inquiry at a subsequent meeting if, in fact, he couldn't answer it at the first meeting?
That sales rep could follow up. There's a lot of different things you could do with a situation like that. And again, that not everything is scripted, so it would depend on the circumstances.
What I'm trying to get at is whether or not these sales representatives have a continuing relationship with a particular physician population, and if so, what is it based on?
Well, it's absolutely. Now, keep in mind that usually the geographies are separated by specialties. So our sales representative was represented two psychiatrists. So she would be trying to understand the psychiatrist patient population, what that psychiatrist finds important, what issues a psychiatrist has, what concerns a psychiatrist has. So it would be somewhat unusual for the psychiatrist to say, and by the way, I have high blood pressure.
It wouldn't be for the internal medicine.
Right. And so depending on the patient population, the sales representative would be prepared to talk about things of interest to that doctor. But the other thing I want to mention is that visit to the doctor, that's the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there is all sorts of work that goes into that in terms of this job, analyzing market trends, looking at the prescriptions that are being written, looking what's happening with the competitor. I mean, the plaintiff in our case said that she worked 90 hours a week. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's her testimony. So the question is, you know, she's visiting doctors maybe a few hours a day. What's she doing the rest of the time? The answer is preparing for those visits with the doctors, deciding how to allocate her resources.
It makes a difference if you're doing with specialists, but what about family practice? Because that's much broader, and you will get the kind of questions that may be across the board.
That's true. I mean, and the sales force would be trained to, and they would have the targeting to address the doctors that they thought would be interested in the medicines that they were selling. It could be multiple medicines. It just depends on the sales district. And by the way, a lot of sales districts rotate out their medicines. So, for example, they might be promoting something at a particular time, and then they might change. So, and in this case, there's evidence of a tremendous amount of training. I mean, Ms. Schaefer-LaRose spent 30 days in sales school. She also talked about having to master a huge amount of information about disease states, about competitors, and about this product. So I guess what I want to come away with is this isn't the Fuller Brush salesman. She's not going to someone's door to say, will you buy a brush? She's developing a complex amount of information for these complex interactions with physicians. So that's, I think, is crossing the line between the issue of general business operations, which is kind of this white collar servicing the business, and then the idea of exercising discretion, which also comes into play in this job. I think the record here clearly reflects the exercise of discretion. I was interested to hear the DOL say that Ms. Schaefer-LaRose did not read from a script. We think that's absolutely true, absolutely supported by the record. That's not exactly what I thought they were saying in their brief, but I'm happy that we all agree now that Ms. Schaefer-LaRose did not read from a script. The record doesn't reflect that.
Mr. O'Brien agrees to that.
I guess you're right. I overstated. I'm glad to be in agreement with the Department of Labor, though, at least on one point.
Yes, I'm sure you wanted to find something on which you agreed with the Department of Labor.
And on that point, on the point that they...
Let me ask you one more thing about what Ms. Starrett said. She mentioned the exemption for highly paid professional workers, and that's $100,000 a year. I take it that the plaintiffs would qualify as professional workers, even if they don't otherwise meet the requirements. Have you relied on that in the district court as a fallback if you lose this appeal?
I'm hoping that won't be necessary. But, yes, we did assert that highly compensated exemption in the court below. With this particular plaintiff, it just so happens that she made over $100,000 in almost all time periods, but there was one part of one time period, and it's 7 weeks, and I think it comes on the very beginning, where she made a little bit less. So it's not a total 100% winner in the court below, but we did argue it, and the district court said that it wasn't necessary to decide it because of the other exemptions. And I will add, Judge, that even for the idea of salary, the Department of Labor has also said that even if you don't meet highly compensated, how much money you make is relevant in deciding if you're an administrative employee.
Okay.
On the concept of scripts and discretion, I just want to emphasize, and I don't know if that I've adequately answered your question about how many products you can promote, but there is far more to this job than just that interaction with the physician.
And the problem with your case is I think the distinction between making sales, selling individual sales, as opposed to having responsibility for the general, the sales posture of the company is in fact important in the administrative exception. And I think the law does support that. And so what I'm trying to find out is which side you fall on. And I'm having trouble getting answers on that.
Well, I would say, Judge, she is not just doing individual sales work. She is developing relations with physicians that are long-term. If you look at Ms. Schaefer-LaRose's job description, this is her key job here, five key areas. Achieve sales growth and territory, professionally promote Lilly products. 3, conduct analysis on product and market trends. That's one of her key job areas. 4, develop and execute territory business plans. 5, coordinate with territory partners. All of those things are the hallmark of administrative work. So I think to say that this is just an individual selling interaction is vastly understating the nature of what she does.
Well, there's no way of knowing, as I understand it, of tracking what sales she makes. Not that there's an actual sales, but what the doctor's prescribing of Lilly products.
The tracking is done by market, so it's not traced to an individual prescription. You were totally right about that. But again, if you look at this, if the nature of the job is not just an individual sales job, and I do want to point out, Your Honor, that in the preamble to the regulation, this is what the department says. The department notes that outside sales employees may also qualify as exempt executive, administrative, or professional employees, so that they specifically say you can be doing sales and you can still be meeting the other exemptions. So, again, to be, I think, a fair synopsis of this job is far more than making just individual sales. And to go back, I think, to my beginning point, we believe that the facts of this case clearly put Ms. Schaefer-LaRose in the outside sales exemption as well as the administrative exemption for the reasons I stated. Thank you very much, and I appreciate the extra time.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.